Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anthony Bubalo, and I'm the Research Director here at the Lowy Institute. Welcome to this very special address. This year's Lowy Institute poll underlined that Australians are indeed worried about their security. In fact, Australians are more worried about their security than at any other time in our 11-year history of polling. And it's also clear from that poll that terrorism is the primary cause of that fear. When we ask them to rank a long list of threats to their security, both internal and external, terrorism ranked 1, 2, and 3. It's also the case, as becoming increasingly clear, that the terrorist threat that we face now is more serious than the one that we faced in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. It's not just the ability of terrorist groups like Islamic State to exploit the modern media through their gruesome YouTube videos to instill fear in our societies. It's not just that through the phenomenon of homegrown terrorism, the terrorist threat now seems more insidious and more random. It's also because, as we're seeing in Syria and Iraq, in the large numbers of foreigners, including Australians, that have gone to those countries, there is a real risk that in coming years we will see highly skilled and highly networked terrorists flow out of Iraq and Syria, potentially coming home to countries like Australia or going home to Europe or elsewhere, or that they will end up in other conflict zones around the world, making those conflicts worse. Certainly, the Institute itself has, over the last year, spent a bit more of its time and its research resources looking at this problem. Earlier this year, Andrew Zammit, a young researcher, published a comprehensive paper on both the history and the future of Australian foreign fighters and some of the risks involved. That was published in April of this year. We're also currently working on some research which is looking at the threat in the future, particularly the Indonesian angle of it, and the way in which Islamic State is using the media to propagate its message. So look out for those over coming months. Now, because the threat is more serious, it also raises some very serious questions about how we manage it, not just to protect ourselves from the threat, but also to ensure that in our policies and in our efforts to deal with this threat, we don't do violence to the things that we are trying to protect, to our social cohesion, to our freedoms of speech and our various liberties. And finding a balance between those is inevitably going to be tricky, and it's going to test our political leaders both at state and federal level. And what that means is you really do need an effective strategy. So we are very delighted to welcome today a man who, in large part, will be responsible for managing the strategy that the government announced yesterday at the COAG meeting. Australia's counter-terrorism strategy. The Honourable Michael Keenan, MP, the Minister for Justice and the Minister assisting the PM on CT, is a very welcome guest here to the Institute. We're very keen to hear him talk about Australia's counter-terrorism strategy. The Minister was elected to the House of Representatives for Stirling in Western Australia in 2004. He held the position of Shadow Minister for Justice, Customs and Border Protection for 4 years before becoming the Minister in 2013. He served on numerous committees, including the Joint Select Committee on the Christmas Island Tragedy from March to June of 2011, and the Joint Select Committee on Australia's Immigration Detention Network from June 2011 to March 2012. Before he entered Parliament, the Minister was the Ministerial Advisor to the ACT Deputy Chief Minister from 96 to 98 and held a number of positions overseas, including with the London Daily Telegraph. Please join me in welcoming Minister Michael Keenan.
Well, thank you, Anthony, for that introduction, and it is great to be here at the Lowy Institute to make this address today, and I can appreciate everybody joining us for it. And I think how this institute came to exist is actually a very good starting point for my address today. The Lowy Institute has been created out of the generosity of a former refugee who came to Australia and then proceeded to take advantage of all the opportunities that our country has to offer. He then took this business internationally to again display to the world Australian know-how and our can-do attitude. Now, I'm sorry that Frank Lowy couldn't be here today, but I am grateful for the opportunity and appreciate what he has done with the Institute, and we certainly wish him well with his recovery. Stories like Frank Lowy's are a great reminder to me of the achievement of modern Australia. This is a place where people can arrive, be accepted regardless of their background, and go on to make a life amongst one of the luckiest places in the world. This is an opportunity that remains open to each and every Australian. Australians are a very welcoming people with a long history of embracing new arrivals. We manage our diversity in a way that should be the model for the rest of the world, and we have avoided the mistakes that I think are evident elsewhere. We have done this in the face of many challenges, and we should reaffirm our commitment to it, undeterred by the new security threat that we are confronting that was outlined by Anthony in his introduction. It is the strength of our culture that will be the most effective weapon to protect the Australian people from the threat of terrorism. This threat has grown in a new and unpredictable and chilling fashion over the past year, and has already resulted in two terror attacks on Australian soil. Our authorities have disrupted a further six potential terror attacks. We expect that this threat is going to be ongoing and be with us for years. The breakdown of the Syrian state has allowed the most violent and barbaric terror movement to establish a footprint over large parts of Syria and western Iraq. It now claims to control an area larger than Lebanon, where they oppress through fear and violence. This base has created the wealthiest terror organisation that has ever existed, now estimated to hold assets in excess of $1 billion. ISIL's unprecedented expansion is acting as a magnet for extremists, including many from the West. Our agencies are seeing an increase in individuals providing support to terrorist groups, both domestically and abroad. Around 120 Australians are currently fighting in Syria and Iraq. Up to 35 Australians are already believed to have been killed. There are approximately 160 people here in Australia actively supporting extremist groups through financing and recruitment. ASIO is currently investigating 400 high priority cases, a number that's almost double from this time last year. ISIL has effectively outsourced terrorism by urging its supporters overseas to carry out attacks. Attacks which, as the Prime Minister has stated, require little more than a camera phone, a knife and a victim. It emphasises that there is no need to consult with anybody, including ISIL itself, before launching attacks. Such a prescription makes attacks unpredictable and therefore much harder for our agencies to counter. Terrorist attack planning is becoming more frequent, warning times are shrinking, and the perpetrators are becoming younger. Police have concerns for teenagers as young as 14, but sadly, this might not be the youngest person that ISIL radicalises and incites to violence. It is no exaggeration to state that Australians are facing the most significant ongoing threat from terrorism in our nation's history. This government is not and has never been ignorant of the threat. Since arriving in office, we have been on the front foot in responding to this new national threat environment. We have invested an additional $1.3 billion to support our counter-terrorism efforts in this budget alone. We've also passed four tranches of legislation to strengthen the ability of our intelligence and law enforcement agencies to investigate, monitor, arrest and prosecute homegrown extremists and returning foreign fighters. We have improved and modernised the legislation governing Australia's intelligence agencies. We've stopped extremists from training and fighting in overseas conflicts where they could gain and will gain the capacity to conduct attacks upon their return. We've made it an offence punishable by up to 10 years in prison for any Australian to enter a declared area without a legitimate purpose. We've lowered the arrest threshold and strengthened our control order regime for our law enforcement agencies, which has so far proven instrumental in disrupting and preventing terrorist attacks against Australians. And we've passed data retention legislation that is vital to the investigation of security threats. The government has also introduced legislation to strip Australian citizenship from dual nationals who engage in terrorism. We want to ensure that dual nationals who engage in terrorism are prevented from returning to Australia, and those within Australia who engage in terrorism can be removed where possible. The threat is constantly evolving, so our response needs to be flexible and adaptable. We continue to take into account lessons that we've learned from recent counter-terrorism operations. Since last September, 23 people have been charged as a result of 8 counter-terrorism operations around the country. But when disrupting an attack, evidence to secure a conviction is not always guaranteed. Our police do not have the luxury to watch and wait. Saving lives will always be their main priority. This should not be controversial, but critics are quick to judge. And some of those critics have attacked the police for targeting the Islamic community. But as I have said many times, we are not the enemies of Islam, nor the enemies of any other religion. This is not about targeting Muslims. As Australians, our strength comes from our diversity. It comes from our inclusion and it comes from our culture. We should all be smart enough not to confuse the acts of a violent extremist minority with the beliefs of hundreds of thousands of law-abiding Australian Muslims. However, our law enforcement agencies have a job to do. They must protect the community and they will apply our laws equally and without discrimination in order to do so. We will not and have not hesitated. We've cancelled the passports of individuals who want to join terrorist groups overseas. To date, more than 120 passports have been cancelled and 16 passports have been refused. 12 passports have been suspended by the Foreign Minister under new powers granted to her in our foreign fighters legislation last year. Our border protection agencies continue to do important work in stemming the movements of departing and returning foreign fighters. The Australian Border Force's counter-terrorism units, which are placed at Australia's major international airports, have successfully intercepted a number of individuals. Overseas, we're committed to attacking ISIL at its source. Australian forces have joined an international coalition designed to blunt ISIL's advance and build the capacity of the Iraqi state. ISIL's deep roots in Syria represent a long-term threat to the region's stability. Stopping ISIL's contagion is therefore a key priority. It has already taken advantage of insecurity in Lebanon, Yemen, Libya, Egypt, Kuwait, and Tunisia to conduct attacks and bolster its ranks. We must ensure that we remain ahead of the terrorists at all times. Criminals are adept at exploiting emerging opportunities and perceived gaps in law enforcement information and capability. Because of this, our law enforcement and intelligence agencies are increasingly dependent on timely and accurate information to keep Australians safe. By making our information sharing stronger, we will be able to disrupt these terrorist threats more quickly. It is just one example of why it's vitally important that the Commonwealth continues to engage with the states and the territories who play such a critical role in community engagement and in countering terrorism. In today's environment, it is more important than ever to ensure that our security and non-security efforts to combat homegrown terrorism are coordinated and effective. This is one of the key functions that the Prime Minister has tasked me with my new role, and together with Greg Moriarty, Australia's counter-terrorism coordinator, we will continue to work with the states and territories to make sure that we have the strategies in place to stay one step ahead. Yesterday, COAG released Australia's counter-terrorism strategy, which sets out our coordinated national approach to counter-terrorism. The strategy explains the threat and how our governments are working together and in partnership with communities in the private sector to counter it. The strategy addresses the entire violent extremist spectrum from radicalisation to carrying out an attack. It focuses on 5 core elements with prevention as the first line of defence: challenging violent extremist ideologies, stopping people from becoming terrorists, shaping the global environment, disrupting terrorist activity within Australia, and having robust response and recovery arrangements should an attack occur. Importantly, the strategy embodies the spirit of working together with the states and territories. As first responders to a terrorist incident, states and territories are on the front line of our counter-terrorism efforts. When the events in Martin Place unfolded last year, it was the New South Wales Police that led the response. After an attack, the states supply shelter, reconstruct damaged areas, and provide healthcare services. They are also responsible for the imprisonment and ongoing custody of convicted terrorists. Therefore, a comprehensive counter-terrorism strategy must be a national one. We have seen joint Commonwealth state counter-terrorism teams rolled out in each jurisdiction and the formation of the Australian Federal Police's National Disruption Group. Yesterday, COAG agreed to introduce a new National Terrorism Threat Advisory System. The changes will give us greater flexibility and precision to the definition of the threat levels. Panic and uncertainty are central to acts of terrorism. Our new threat levels will provide more information on what the threat means, where the threat is coming from, potential targets, and the means of an attack. Despite all our efforts, Australians continue to be groomed by the terrorists who play upon the vulnerable and the young to recruit them to this vile cause. Young women are still volunteering to be terrorist brides, only to arrive and be sold off to murderers. Young men and women are brainwashed to the point where they will blow themselves and others up. Every country in the world is grappling with the same question. What makes people susceptible to both extremist influences and recruitment by terrorists? There is no one answer to this problem and no silver bullet. Across the world, multifaceted approaches are being trialled to stop individuals heading down the dark path of radicalisation. What we do know is that countering violent extremism will not work in isolation from broader social cohesion policies. This is why the Australian government has committed $660 million for initiatives within the social services portfolio. We are investing in social harmony, settlement, and cohesion in our communities. No one group in Australia sits outside and apart from the opportunities that our country has so effectively offered to waves of new migrants. If we can prevent vulnerable people from feeling further alienated by ensuring they have a sense of belonging, a part of a strong and supportive community, then we can stop some from becoming susceptible to violent extremism in the first place. Engaging our youth is imperative in helping us to reject hatred and intolerance. We provide nearly $2 million every year to national initiatives such as student workshops, education materials, and employment assistance. We have committed a further $200,000 to the AFL's Bashir Hawley Academy, a leadership program for junior footballers of Muslim background. We've also allocated $500,000 to the Islamic Museum for new education programs to promote understanding amongst children and the general public of Islamic culture and its contribution to society throughout history. But it is also critical to recognise when at-risk individuals may need help from specialised intervention programs. We have provided funding of nearly $12 million under our Living Safe Together program to directly engage with those showing signs of radicalised thinking and identify what response is required through unique case management support. Some of these services may be accessible through mainstream government programs, but many will be best delivered by communities themselves. For this reason, we have provided community funding of nearly $2 million to over 40 organisations to significantly boost the ability of such groups to work with vulnerable individuals. What we know is that a community group can be better placed than the government to provide support to these individuals. However, there is also organisations where, due to the very nature of the intervention work that they are conducting, talking about them publicly will undermine what has been achieved. Despite our considerable social and economic investments, ISIL will continue to draw people in with its propaganda. Research has found that ISIL supporters have three times more global friends on Instagram compared to the average Australian user. On Twitter, the Brookings Institute found that ISIL and its supporters had at least 46,000 active accounts, each with an average of 1,000 followers. This indicates that they have developed a deep and pervasive network of supporters that can spread their messages instantaneously across all corners of the globe. They produce an array of magazines, videos, and graphics, which is shared and distributed further by online followers. This is where the threat is born, and the government has invested $22 million to tackle it. We're already working with social media platforms such as Twitter, Facebook, and Google, as well as organisations like the Australian Communications Media Authority, to take down violent extremist material. Google has provided a startup funding for an app to connect mentors and mentees, because those feeling disempowered and isolated are at greater risk of radicalisation. The recent hackabout held during the CVE summit here in Sydney provided a platform for developing efforts that chip away at the drivers of radicalisation, whether it be isolation, the promise of adventure that ISIL offers, or the need for community mentors. This year, we also launched a Report Online Extremism tool to improve the ability of Australians to report violent extremist material that's found over the internet. Reports are already being referred to law enforcement and security agencies, and where appropriate, to social media providers to take down content that is unacceptable. But our focus is not solely on taking down content. The reality is that no one idea will prevent radicalisation. To better understand why it is that people have been lured in by these terrorists, our operatives will monitor and analyse the lies that are being generated. With this knowledge, we will be able to fight their messaging through a range of overt and covert means. We will give voice to those in our community who can reach our target audiences with messaging that challenges the terrorists' false claims. We must teach our children that they cannot believe everything they read on the internet, and teach them to be able to identify these lies for what they are. To help with this task, we have appointed a new Children's eSafety Commissioner to coordinate Australia's approach to protecting our children against not just pedophiles, but also the terrorists who would take advantage of their innocence. We've also initiated a new project with the Australian Multicultural Foundation to help parents identify and manage the risks of online radicalisation. Just as parents and families have gained a greater understanding of the dangers posed by online sexual predators, there needs to be an increased awareness of the threat from online terrorist groomers. Well-informed and well-equipped families, strong communities, and cohesive institutions such as schools and workplaces will be the front line of our defence of terrorism at home. But this threat of terrorism is not one that Australia faces alone, and it is one that knows no boundaries. While we're doing great work at home, in order to challenge the pervasive and global threat of terrorism, collective international action is required. To begin with, we must look to address the threat of terrorism within our own region. We're concerned that in Southeast Asia, where governments have made so much progress over the last decade in attacking terrorist networks, that ISIL is serving to inspire and re-energise existing extremist groups. ISIL's toxic message is infiltrating groups in Indonesia, Malaysia, and in the Philippines. Already we're seeing signs in social media that the recent attack in Tunisia is motivating extremists in our own region to contemplate similar attacks. In March this year, Indonesia's Vice President Yusuf Kalla said the spread of ISIL's ideology and its recruitment of Indonesians was a direct threat to Indonesia's national security. This statement occurred just after Indonesia's National Police Anti-Terrorism Unit arrested 5 men in raids in Jakarta. Similarly, Malaysia, as chair of this year's ASEAN summit, recognised the growing threat of radicalisation and violent extremism and the real and present danger it poses to our region. Such expressions of concern demonstrate the need for countries in the region to stand together to develop shared strategies to combating terrorist acts and propaganda. Our collective efforts to combat terrorism is a critical priority. I will be seeking to further advance our counter-terrorism cooperation when I visit Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore next month, building on the trip I took to the region last year. Australia is seeking to enhance information sharing, promote legislative reform, improve international crime cooperation and border management, and develop tools to combat radicalisation via social media. At the other end of the so-called foreign fighter pipeline, we're strengthening our cooperation with the countries of the Middle East. As part of the government's response to foreign fighters, we've expanded the Australian Federal Police's footprint in the region with new AFP positions in both Ankara and Amman. These officers already share real-time intelligence and evidence in support of domestic and international disruption activities. They form part of the AFP's international network across 29 countries and the 16 bilateral counter-terrorism cooperation agreements that we have worldwide. We're also leading regional efforts to tackle the issue of terrorism and radicalisation. In June, Australia hosted the Regional Summit to Counter Violent Extremism. During the summit, regional leaders and Australian community partners had an opportunity to exchange ideas and discuss lessons learnt in countering violent extremism. We also agreed to strengthen our engagement with the private sector, identify the best ways to neutralise terrorist propaganda, and further invest in communities and in community organisations that are the first line of defence when countering violent extremism. These outcomes will form part of the region's contribution to the United Nations General Assembly's leaders' meeting on countering violent extremism. We in Australia are not the type of people to sit back and watch as things happen. We have been on the front foot when it comes to global action on terrorism. The threat of terrorism has not been underestimated by your government. Our determined responses are far-reaching, and to date they have been largely successful. From social cohesion policies, to intervention programs, to disrupting terrorist attacks, to negotiating international agreements, we are addressing the full spectrum of terrorism threats. The threat of terrorism is dynamic, but so is the resolve of this government to keep Australians safe.
Thank you, Minister, for that comprehensive overview. The Minister's kindly agreed to take some questions. Please, when I point to you, wait till the microphone arrives. Tell us who you are. And given that there will undoubtedly be a lot of questions, please keep it to a question rather than a statement. But before I turn to the floor, I want to take the Chair's privilege and ask a question myself. You mentioned that you're heading up to Indonesia. This week, the Lowy Institute launched the latest of its Lowy Institute papers, published by Penguin Australia, available at all good bookstores, Condemned to Crisis by Ken Ward, which talks about, it's a thoroughgoing look at the Australia-Indonesia relationship and its crisis-prone nature. Given the recent tensions in the relationship over the executions of Chan and Sukumaran, how confident are you that you'll be able to build the effective CT cooperation with Indonesia, given some of those difficulties?
Thank you for the question. It's a very good question. I'm very confident that we will continue our cooperation with Indonesia on the counter-terrorism front because it is just so vitally important for both countries. And we have a very long track record of success, I think, with our cooperation with Indonesia, particularly in the wake of the Bali bombings, where the cooperation between the Indonesian National Police and the Australian Federal Police was really formed. And those relationships are very vital. We have a strong Australian Federal Police presence in Indonesia. They are very effective in working with their counterparts. Certainly, I think when there's other troubles within the relationship, we cannot lose sight on the vital importance of that bilateral cooperation to counter national security threats in both our countries. I am very confident that that will continue. And even when there has been some speed humps in the past, that cooperation has still been ongoing.
Thank you. I'll take some questions from the floor now. Raise your hands. Don't be shy.
Minister, thank you for that excellent address. John Yates, I'm currently the Director of Security for Westfield, but I ask this question as the former head of counterterrorism in the United Kingdom. I just wonder, you don't say so explicitly in your speech, but I suspect that you, like other Five Eyes communities, adopt a zero-tolerance approach to terrorist attacks, so any attack that gets through is a disaster. I just wonder, the question is, in terms of, does that approach magnify the impact of any attack that's doing the terrorist jobs for them? And secondly, is it time for us to accept that attacks will get through, say so explicitly, and prioritise our resources where they do the most harm?
Well, I mean, that is a very good question. I mean, the threat is very real. I mean, we've never in our history before had the terrorism threat alert level raised to high, and that means that an attack in Australia is probable. There has been 2 successful attacks within the last year. Because of the very good work of the Australian Federal Police and their intelligence partners, we've disrupted a further 6 attacks. Now, since September, that means that they've essentially been taking disruption action, or there's been a successful attack every 5 weeks. So the scale of the threat is enormous, and no person, I think, could realistically stand before you and say that there's no chance of another successful terrorist attack in this country. But I can say that the government, working in conjunction with our partners in the states and territories, are doing absolutely everything we can to stop that from happening. We've given our agencies the tools they need to stop it. We've given our agencies the resources they need to stop it. But by the same token, it's just the scale of what is happening that means that it is impossible for someone to give you a guarantee that there won't be another successful attack. But as I said, we're doing absolutely everything we can to stop that from occurring.
Given the scale of that attack, should the Australian population be allowed to arm themselves, or at least in sensitive places like shopping centres and so on?
I think that's probably the exact opposite of the response that we want. I mean, I want the Australian community to be well aware that there is a changing threat environment in Australia. They need to know that in the past year the security situation has deteriorated here significantly. But it's the job of the government and our agencies to address that. I don't think the idea of sort of citizens addressing that on their own is going to be helpful at all. People need to have confidence in the people that we do have. I don't say this with any sense of hyperbole. I think that we have the best law enforcement and intelligence apparatus in the world. They are extremely successful at keeping us safe. And I would ask the Australian people to have every confidence in that. And I don't think sort of addressing it in the way that you suggested is going to be particularly helpful.
Hi, David Hammond from the Institute for Economics and Peace. I'm just wondering, one of your 5 pillars was prevention. What are the push and pull factors, and what communities are being targeted by the government at the moment? Not targeted, addressed.
I'm not sure what you mean by push and pull factors, to be honest.
Well, what are the risk factors for radicalisation that the government is looking into?
Who do we believe is vulnerable?
Yeah, and what characteristics do they have?
Well, I mean, obviously the cohort that's most vulnerable to radicalisation and most vulnerable to hearing these violent, this violent ideology that's emanating from ISIL is youth, and youth within the Islamic community are obviously the most susceptible to these messages, but it's not just restricted to that. But we need to be careful about characterising what is the individual makeup of somebody who might be attracted to this, because what we're finding is that people are attracted to this violent ideology from quite a diverse background, and they can also be from very different demographic groups. I mean, we've seen people who certainly don't conform to the idea of someone who's that isolated or that even that disconnected. And people who have gone and fought or support these terror groups can come from quite different backgrounds. So, look, we're trying to work with people that we deem to be vulnerable through the communities of which they're a part, because if they're connected to the community, if they feel a part of the community, then obviously they're not going to go down this dark path of radicalisation. But we need to be careful not to be willfully blind to the fact that people can be radicalised from very different backgrounds.
Minister, one of the other questions that in fact was raised by a ministerial colleague of yours, Malcolm Turnbull, is this whole question about the balance between security versus liberty in crude terms. But how you balance the efforts that government needs to take to keep the community safe with the need to protect some of those things that define us as a community, some of those liberties and freedoms. How is the government going about managing that balance, and how do you know that you've got it right?
Look, it's an excellent question. We shouldn't always look at the debate, I think, as a trade-off between security and liberty, but obviously there is a trade-off involved in some of the policy prescriptions that we've put forward. Now, I didn't get into Parliament, and most of my colleagues didn't get into Parliament, to increase the power of the state. But by the same token, as a federal government, we need to make sure that there is a regime in place that effectively protects people's security. And of course, it's one of the great liberties of Australians is the liberty not to be killed in a terrorist attack, or not to be have their security infringed in this way. And that is something that we need to be mindful of as well. Look, I think we have taken small steps, I suppose, that you could characterise as eroding liberty in some senses. But ultimately, I believe that we do need to ensure community safety and that the Australian people are prepared for us to make that small trade-off. And that's certainly the impression I get when I've been speaking to people about the changes that we're making. Probably the most controversial was the retention of metadata. Instinctively, that was not a policy that I was attracted to. But you can't possibly be in this role, see the importance of metadata in a national security sense, but also in every other criminal investigation that we do, and not know that retaining that metadata for a prescribed period is actually something that is vitally important for us to do. So I think that, you can argue around the margins. My sense is that we have got that balance right, but we do need to err on the side of community safety, I think.
Thank you, Minister. Aaron Connolly from the Institute. I wanted to ask you, you've characterised your CVE program here as a success, but you're about to head up to Indonesia, which has 250 million Muslims. There are about 500,000 Muslims in Australia, and yet both countries have about the same number of fighters fighting with ISIL in the Middle East. That means there's a radicalization rate of about 1,000 times Indonesia's radicalization rate here in Australia. So I'm wondering, do you think that perhaps Australian Muslims don't feel as though they have the opportunities that Frank Lowy had when he came to this country as a religious minority 60 years ago? Do you think that the Prime Minister's comments back in February and Philip Ruddock's comments surrounding the conversation on citizenship are doing more to make Australian Muslims feel as though they're less a part of this community as opposed to more a part of this community?
Well, look, the government has always been explicit that we stand and seek to represent every single member of the Australian community, and we have constantly said that. But it's vitally important, I think, that we offer that reassurance to people who might feel sometimes that that's not the case. That's part of the role that I've been given explicitly by the Prime Minister. Every Australian needs to understand that their government never targets them based on their background. We don't make any apologies for strengthening the law and going after criminals who are doing the wrong thing. But that is absolutely not the result of somebody's background, religion, culture. That is a result of the fact that we police in this country people who are going to do the wrong thing. I've been talking to a lot of community leaders. I'll continue to talk to a lot of community leaders. I'll continue to provide that reassurance. Australia is still the land of opportunity for everyone who is here. I'm not saying that it's not more challenging if you come from different groups, but we need to constantly, I think, remind everybody that Australians are all equal. This is a great country to live in. We do need to make sure that everybody knows and understands that they're part of that.
Minister Tim Wellington from Commonwealth Bank, do you see a need to do more at the source of the problem, actually tackle the problem in Syria with Australian troops on the ground if the threat continues to grow?
Tim, I think that's an excellent question. And clearly, in Australia and our international partners, this is an issue that is going to need to be grappled with. If Australia were to change its stance, then obviously that would be the result of significant policy consideration at a much higher level than just myself. We're obviously watching. We want to make sure that we're contributing all we can to the destruction and the degradation of ISIL. We are contributing to uphold the Iraqi state, training with them, working with them, and we're contributing to other coalition efforts through airstrikes as well. If there was a need to change that, then obviously the government would carefully consider that in conjunction with our foreign partners.
Is there any psychological or psychiatric profile that might be deemed to be common in susceptible individuals that might alert family or friends to potential terrorism?
I don't think there's a psychiatric profile that would be common to everybody who's been radicalised or is supporting ISIL, but there's certainly changes in the way people behave that we should recognise as being indicators that they are moving down a very dark path. And what we want to do is to make sure that community institutions, such as schools, even families, could recognise that they've got somebody within their family, within their community, whose behaviour is changing in a way that should lead them to have some concerns. And if they do have those concerns, what they can actually do about it. So there's certainly changes in behaviour that should alert those around that person that something quite dark is going on. And then what we want to do is make sure we've got institutions to recognise that and address it.
Minister Peter Trude from Australian Associated Press. A foreign fighter will be returning to Australia at some stage today with the AFP. What's the government's view of the role that that person has undertaken and how our society should perceive having somebody like that back in the country?
Well, I'm not in a position to be able to comment on individual cases, but I can make a general point that we have changed the laws in Australia to make sure that if you go and fight alongside a terror organisation, if you support a terror organisation, then you are committing an offence under Australian law. And the Australian government is going to do everything we can to make sure that our agencies are equipped to prosecute jail people who do support or fight alongside a terror organisation. So, look, I can't comment on specifics. Obviously, I'm aware of the media that's been around the case that you've just raised. But we're going to do everything we can to make sure that people who have supported this organisation, this barbarous, violent organisation, account for their crime.
Michael Katz, ING Bank. To what extent does your definition of counterterrorism link up with the cybersecurity problems that we face, and to the extent that cybersecurity is now such an important part of our social being?
Look, in the online environment, it's more the very effective use of social media by ISIL that concerns me the most. Cybersecurity is vitally important. It's not something that I'm as concerned about from a counterterrorism perspective, but certainly we are from a national security perspective. But the actors, I think, that are threatening our cybersecurity are probably different than the organisations that we're targeting in the counterterrorism area.
My name is Sri Krishna and I'm a medical practitioner. My question is, with radicalisation, don't you think the precursor stage is actually religious fanaticism, and are there measures in place to deal with that?
Sorry, I missed the last part of your question.
Well, the question was that, radicalisation doesn't just come on its own, and perhaps religious fanaticism is a precursor to that. And do you have any measures to deal with that?
You're right. I mean, radicalisation occurs as part of a process, and we have put a lot of work into understanding how it is that people come to be radicalised. And that's having the extremist views and then translating those extremist views into violent extremism, which, of course, is what we're most concerned about. So that we are doing all we can to understand the pathology of somebody who can go from a very short space of time for having quite mainstream views to be radicalised quite quickly. And, of course, we're very concerned that it's happening to younger and younger people, and that's how ISIL are reaching out. Just to explain how they do it, I mean, they've got this enormous social media apparatus, and what they do is they put out a vast amount of messages, and then in return they would get, one or two people who might send some messages back and what have you, and then they can sort of work on that people or groom those people, and their message to them is to go out and commit attacks where you are. You don't need to come and support us here in the caliphate. You don't need to travel to Syria or Iraq. I mean, you can take action on behalf of ISIL where you are, and you can do it based on tools that you find, unfortunately, just around a home. So, we're trying to understand the pathology about why someone can be taken for a very short space of time to hold these radical views, and most importantly, what we're going to do to recognise it and then intervene to stop it from happening. And when I say we're trying to understand it, we're doing an enormous amount to disrupt that process from occurring. Everything from wider social cohesion through to intervening where we know an individual has, where we know we're concerned about a particular individual.
Thank you, Minister. In the United States, the Department of Justice has a theory that they call the Caldor Doctrine. It basically says that foreign bribery and corruption adds to the economic difficulties of communities and can breed terrorism, extremism. Can you outline some of the financial crime investigation priorities for Australia?
Well, interestingly enough, you're sitting just behind Paul Jeftovic, the CEO of AUSTRAC, the counter-terrorism finance authority that we have. Look, as part of our budget measures, Paul has a new team specifically designed to counter terrorism financing. And obviously, the remit of AUSTRAC has always been to make sure that Australians don't involve themselves in corruption in overseas countries or be a resting place for corrupt funds from other countries. I think it's always very important that we do everything we can to stop corruption and sure, I can understand that that is a factor that does allow some of these political movements, to thrive. But we have always been very robust about the way we tackle corruption, and Australia has always been very keen to make sure that we're not a haven for corrupt funds coming from anywhere else. And we've taken very explicit action to make sure that Australians can't involve themselves in money laundering or terrorism financing.
Hey, Minister, Roger Shannon from the Lowy Institute. Just to follow on from the previous question about returning foreign fighters, there have been a number of Australians who have fought with Kurdish groups, various Kurdish groups. Is the government's intent to pursue them legally to the same degree that Australian foreign fighters for Islamic State invariants in the future?
Well, the law applies equally to everyone, and we want to discourage Australians from participating in this conflict in any capacity. So we don't make exceptions if you go to fight in Iraq or Syria, depending on which side of that conflict you fight on. And look, we will continue to uphold the law. And the law of Australia is that we don't want Australians going to participate in any way, shape or form in these conflicts. We don't want to contribute to those conflicts, but also I might say it's a danger to the Australians themselves who would participate, who are putting themselves in mortal danger if they involve themselves in these conflicts, as we've tragically seen, I think, over the last 48 hours.
Well, Minister, I think we've exhausted the audience or terrorised them. We're really grateful that you've taken time out from your very busy schedule, especially after yesterday's big announcement at COAG, to come and spend a bit of time with us here and talk about your very, very onerous responsibilities. You did that incredibly well and comprehensively. Unfortunately, it's an issue that I don't think is going to go away, and so there'll be plenty of work for you and your team to do in the future, and we'd love to have you back at some time in the future to talk again about how you're responding to this a serious and no doubt a long-term problem that we face. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Minister Michael Chong. Thanks for your time today, and we'll see you all next time.